Well, hello, I'm David Cheesham, and I'm here with Greg Gussie, who is a phenomenal artist and poet and promoter of the arts. I think if you're in the Valley and you have produced quality art, you have probably had some contact with Greg Gussie over the years, but he's also has many stories to tell throughout his life, and we're here. We're going to hear some poems and talk about them. We've been talking about mortality before the show, kind of talking and thinking about what we're going to talk about today, and you have sadly had to think about mortality for a while.
Well, probably thinking about it more than I should, but I was diagnosed with pretty severe cancer last year, and so we're in the mode of counting the days. So and one of the things one thinks about is dying and how unprepared we are to die. You know, you would think in our culture of, you know, I mean, we've been doing this for a million years now, that we would have some training or expectations on what it is we're supposed to do.
Mm-hmm.
It's a big social hole.
Right, and we fill that by hiding from it, by the stories that we tell about it, by what else? How do we fill that hole?
Well, I mean, mostly we just ignore it. I mean, mm-hmm. whether it's our food or our lives. And I think the saddest part about it is not being trained to die. We also are never trained to live. We miss that that aspect because what's that Bob Dylan says? Anybody who's not busy being born is busy dying.
Uh-huh.
And that's pretty much the state of our existence. So most of the poems that, well, not most, but quite a few of the poems that we'll deal with today are on that subject. Certainly not, I should say, mortality is not morbidity. And mortality is in itself not a morbid subject. Mm-hmm. It's just something that we do. But people get confused on that.
Right, right. I think you said that you can live better or live more well or more in focus when you know that this is what you have.
Yeah, I think my line is, it's pretty liberating to be able to see the bus that's going to hit you. And it is. If you know your time is limited, you realize that all those things you've heard, counterculture about living for the day or pursuing what you really desire and forgetting the rest is it's much more important than we're first left, till we're ever led on to believe. I mean, no one lives for the day except Baba Ram Dass. And, of course, when he got cancer, he switched his whole thing and began preaching about hope and the future.
Interesting. I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's kind of curious. So.
Well, okay. Well, there's a poem sitting on that desk in front of you. Is that something you want to read?
Well, there are quite a few of them.
There are quite a few, yes.
About 300, and no, I'm not going to read them all.
Okay.
But sure, I could start with one. This one here is called Crash of Glass, and it happens to be the only one that Marianne Cockle likes, so it's important that we read it.
Marianne is a mutual friend who is a very strict reader, and for her to like something means a lot.
I think so.
Yeah.
So, crash of glass. And he threw open, with a crash of glass, his windows to the ragged storm. Could he catch a breath of her? And he called to the smell of distant seas on those thrashing winds. Is she on your waves and troughs? Fill the hole to the deep hell in me. Charcoal thunder resounds the stretched void and the taste of prairie and step, and his sand-blistered tongue brought no waving grass memory of her wrapped in sweet green, the rains churned to ice, no signs within the raft of six-pointed white stars. Cold of the dead was his soft heart. The wind cried like a dark galaxy of lone creatures and moaned like forests stripped of leaves. He reloved an embracing dance and a honeysuckle song on wet lips, so very long gone, and his tears showered him till he melted away into a running torrent. That's that one.
That's Crash of Glass. And images are just beautiful. I can see why she would like this. It's just active and physical. Was this a recent one?
I did about 6-7 months ago, I believe it was. Yeah, again, it's in that same thing. One of the issues with death and dying is memories, mm-hmm. and how we deal with them and how we can restore them and recreate them. Because I used to have a collection of rocks, little tiny pebbles I picked up all over the world. It was kind of like, like some people's photo collection. I would go to them and seemingly talk to them, and they'd talk to me. And I don't have those anymore, but it's still the idea of, it can be great fun to look back on your life and see what you've accomplished or failed to accomplish. I think I try not to spend too much time on mm-hmm. the failure end.
Sure.
Because there's no fun there.
Yeah. No waving grass memory of her wrapped in sweet green, the rains churned to ice. And you use the language we talked about before, the filling of the hole. So very, very good.
Want to try another one?
Let's try another one.
Okay. Well, this is not on the theme. This was written, this one is on the theme. This one is not on the theme. We'll read this one. This is written about a young lady that we both know, publishes a magazine. We'll try it out. Holding. Bright as sunrise in the midst of midnight, her green olive eyes impersonate your view of her until he comes up in conversation, as he always does. Then a gray cold sea fog, the kind that kills light, rolls in, an albatross of guilt, sadness, loss, and despair. And those olive eyes, pain pitiful, so you want to hold her, comfort her, comb her, caress her, and tell her it's all right. But you can't, because it's the wrong message. You don't want to be fatherly, not to her, and you don't care the least about him, unless you could be him holding her.
Very nice.
Somebody
great,
likes that.
Great. Tells the story in such a condensed way, and you see it coming from very early. So very nice.
And here's one on the subject. I call it The Last Man. There's an old man in here someday, too. But we'll start with this. The Last Man. The last traveling man sings the last road song. Be byway done, been replaced by the expressway, and the tourist replaced the traveler. The outlaw poet and priest, all now deceased. Done walk from Chicago to L.A. with my thumb out the whole way. Saw the children on swing sets, sang with others like me, men who were hanging about. Slept in the dust out on the Winnemucca track and carried my house in a shoulder sack. I'd laid down with the farmer's daughter and shoveled. $100 to buy pen and paper and blotter. Part 2. Yes, the highway to hell is crowded by sallow-eyed boys, reflection of Breton's tombstone in their eyes. Skinny little boys, never played with balls or bats, just slippery words for toys, never time for human love, paying the ultimate price, infinite dissatisfaction, unrelenting masturbation without lines or helpful direction signs. They crowd in quivering mass, often one without discretion, facing themselves both front and back, and a lack of forward motivation. Part 3. The master calls from above to the dismayed commotion that on this path they've breached their destination. I could not believe it was so true. In the sickly yellow glow of sunlight, I could not believe it was so true. I could not believe a poet's destiny. I could not believe it is true. It's a little different than the others.
It is. It feels very much like a beat sort of combining what we used to call high and low culture from Breton to just street life and the rhymes work for that sort of Dylan-esque in places.
I find Gregory Corso probably be my favorite of the uh-huh. beats.
And, yeah.
And if I could catch that that rhythm,
mm-hmm.
it'd be perfect. Haven't yet, but of course there's a lot of despair in Corso. So. Mm-hmm. And who wants to live there?
Right.
It's the wrong town, despair. Yep. And here's another one on the same theme. It's called The Old Man. As a young man, I rode the brake beam, hung tight to the rods, and spit in the old man's eye. As the sands and stones sped by and spitefully followed my dream. I refuse to give in to Peccadillo's iron-eared tragedy or future whims, any handhold he might have had, even beaten bloody and feeling bad on the mother road in yellow Amarilla. His face, a green gun barrel in Berkeley and Isla Vista, and learning at Kent State, too. I laughed at him for my fun. I knew those others were at peril. Then it turned to my 30s, and I sailed away like most do, with dark red wine and sweet cocaine. I ignored the old man, empty-brained, while on my white sails an ocean of invincibility. My children in writing showed me immortality of the spirit and soul in which I believe during those blissful years, not of the corporal body in tears, but I hadn't entered the old man's territory. Time came, the old man came to fight me. Time after time he thought he could take me, and my strong heart beat him back. I told him this was my land. But the old man is a persistent devil, and time is his to bide. Like a game where master lets you win, it's a false pride, my brass horns and revel. How can I fear a face I've known so well, like a lover I've gone to bed with? And I see her grace in the morning light, and I've embraced and held tight, and secrets shared I'll never tell. If I can get it into my head, the old man tells me, if I choose to dance with him and ply the river for a whim, I'll live till I'm dead. Pray for me if it makes you feel better, if it fits your sense of community, but it won't make my end more or less miserable. The old man made my journey so pleasurable, just right for me, and a joyous wonder.
Yes, yeah. So who's the old man?
Death.
Death, of course.
Oh, jeez. Yeah. That was a pretty straightforward one.
Uh-huh, yeah.
And, of course, as we start in our youth, we spit in death's eye because we don't know what it's about. And as we reach the end points, we start to dance with death.
Right.
It's a curious thing. I suppose, you know, he could call an end to the music anytime he wants, but still, he lets you dance for a while.
Very good.
So that's that one. I did bring, just for you, Long Day with Milton and Barrett. I don't know if I've read this before for you or not.
Yeah, I think you read it at the event the other day, and I really enjoyed it. I'm so glad you brought it because I wanted to hear it again.
Well, no one can hear it then. A Long Day with Milton and Barrett. I was moseying about town in the late afternoon, the time when the sun shines oblique, and the golden glow is a gauze and crystalline blue, and my mind's imagining Florentine. I've never seen, only dreamed, but it seems to ethereally resonate in me. A violin's back of little ice-aged wood, vibration caused perhaps by what tips the heartstrings, a drop of the Arno, a drop of Tuscan blood, a drop of a cousin's blood, maybe Galileo. I grasped a handy bench just before time fell on me and took me back, that predator, returning to its den with its scrawny catch. Where it came to me, I was far from away and surrounded by stony Cambridge, but luck still in my own past, forced to consider the plurality of my worlds by the poet sitting beside me. Lime and limpid green, a second scene. He, recently released from hospital and his self-incarcerating dreams, gladly showed me on my own night's vast plains and the women of East Anglia less possessed, as they intersected the valleys and mountains of my mind, just as Galileo showed another poet, who once may have sat on this very revolutionary bench, postured but a flatulent airs released on the top rail, whilst his muddy boots rested on the seat, a landscape that tangled up his time. And it dawned on me that Sisyphus defies the gods, pushing his weight. As we sometimes with just cause rebel similarly, though doomed to fail, returning to the lower realm over our perceived existence. But for a brief moment, we, like our hero, reach an apex, a place where our lens can clearly view our rightful paradise, and unobscured by the history of failed revolutions and returning stones placed upon us, so that Milton may achieve Galileo, and I, my poet. Which is a story about Sid Barrett of a small band named Pink Floyd.
Yes, the early Pink Floyd.
Yes, and the beginning, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so Sid Barrett lived in Cambridge, and Milton also lived in Cambridge. And, of course, Milton was the great poet who wrote Paradise Lost and many, many other things. And he went on a venture to visit Galileo as kind of the opposite of the situation I was in. But the poet wanted to meet the master of the universe. And that was how it went. Kind of interesting story.
Yes.
So I got to do that once.
And you met Sid Barrett. Yes.
And I met Sid Barrett. Yeah. And there was one story I wanted to read. Well, I'll read one more poem. Then if you don't mind, we'll take a break. I'll put my... Nope, there it is, Rain Words. Okay, another type of poetry I like to write is what's called free verse or... Or what's the other?
Prose poetry.
Prose poetry. And you know, all these are just small stories because I can't write long stories. I lose my place. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, I could write novels and short stories. But, yeah. We write poems instead. This one's called Rain Words. It would seem to me we folks of the temperate climes would have as many words for rain as the Eskimo have for snow. Every drop is so singular and unique. Why is there no word for the mist-like rain that falls so softly through the conifer woods of the far north coast, or the torrent pours of the great plains? There is no word for the high mesa rains where giant drops fall far enough apart that a man can walk through the storm without getting wet and yet lay with his love under the tin roof music of its drumming. Nor for the rain that keeps day at bay and silences the rooster, letting us sleep till noon. There is no word for the warm, playful summer rain that brings children dancing near the naked in the fields of the Shenandoah, nor for the freezing rain that tears at the tough hide of marble headers to see, nor for that driven rain like spikes and whips from the Great Lakes. No singular word for the turning leaf willowy mountain rain of melted snowfall, nor for the hurricane rains on South Coast barrier islands. No word exists for the sound of rain on a new growth oak and hickory leaves at the break of spring. And what is the name for that special rain that bounces in a cacophony of thumps on a taunt-skinned umbrella shared with a smiling friend? There is no word for the rare Sonora rain that brings exquisite bloom to the desert world, nor for the rain that feeds us on Kansas wheat and Arkansas rice. No word for the strange yellow glow that comes from the tornado's rain. There isn't even a word for the bone-chilling rain of San Francisco, though it be as apt in Boston. Nor a word for the invariable camper's rain that drenches tents and molders sleeping bags for chattering teeth nights. And how is the rain named that arches and arches and arches again in the enlightening majesty of the divine colors? We need a word for the goodbye rain that hides our tears when the door is slammed, and we hit the cobbled streets, and a word for the gray rain that melts red clay at the casket side. A word, too, for the laughing rain that giggles with us when we run from the great white lawn tents behind the young bride and groom. And a name, too, for that false Sunset Valley fiery rain, frothy and boiling deep. A good Friday rain, a thunderous precursor to the rising. I felt much rain, but the words escaped me. That's a prose poem.
That's a yeah, and it. I get the sense that you've seen every kind of rain that you've described there. That's very good.
I hope I've seen everything I talk about in
yeah.
here.
That's, but it tells yeah. it tells your story while you're talking about the rain. It's,
and that's what we want to do. How about yeah. another rock and roll one?
Okay.
I don't know if any of you are familiar with John Fahey, the great guitarist, 60s, early 70s, he was most famous. And he wrote an album in tune called The Yellow Princess. So this poem is called The Fascist Effects of the Yellow Princess. Mm-hmm. At times, the music makes me wish I were a puppet, carelessly dancing to the complex plucking, a shadow freed to the ultimate control of someone else's dreaming. A sail on the yellow princess lashed to the sturdy yardarm, propelling by taut line and wind to captain's order from lanyard whistle. The strings and binds so lovely and woven, so caressed and sweet and lockstepped frets. Freedom from tiring choice and reason, days rise, nights fall, regardless of me at all.
Hmm. Okay, so tell me a little bit more about, we just heard The Fascist Effects of the Yellow Princess, and I want to get to the title, before, give me the background. This is the guitarist who was famous in the 60s and 70s. And
yeah, John Fahey, of course, played at Monterey and played at... what was that one in Woodstock? That was what they called it.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. And he's a 6 and 12 string guitar player, guitar picker. He didn't sing. And probably his most famous album, at least from 67 or so, was The Yellow Princess, which was his story in music of a great clipper ship making its way from the harbors of Baltimore to the South China Sea. And why I call it the fascist effects is you become controlled by his picking on the strings. It's a it's a control over you that there's nothing you can do about. So that was where the title came from, that what the plucking of the song does to you, makes you round that cape with that big clipper ship.
Mm-hmm.
And, you can't escape it.
And it's a great melding of those of the puppet strings and the guitar strings that you refer to. It's the plucking, and because you know even the plucking of the guitar is like the plucking, similar hand movement of the moving of the puppet. So it's, that's wonderful. And you have in your writing about art, you have, I think, broached on that topic of art that is more controlling or art that's liberating and so forth, I think. And I think you've referred to fascism and art and referring to artists as well. Am I right?
Well, yeah, of course, especially in modern art, the influences of the fascism, influences of communism, and even more so the influences of the propaganda machine in Washington that brought us artists like Jasper Johns, which most people don't know were a creation of the CIA.
Certainly supported by the CIA. Yeah.
Yeah, well, the object was to make Europeans and other Western thinkers believe that the art scene in the United States was just as important and vibrant as any other art scene. And so they went to support avant-garde artists in a notion as a propaganda move. It's very mm-hmm. interesting. There's a whole long new book about it.
Right.
I can read a poem about my art.
Uh-huh.
It's kind of a fun little one. I call it Kites in Trees. I'm sure we've all seen our poor Charlie Brown and his kite in trees. Well, that's exactly what this poem is. It's Kites in Trees. My art is kites in trees. I can see it so high up there, bright, colorful, inextricably woven into leaves and branches, trapped, unattainable. Sometimes a stiff wind will free those thoughts, and they crumble to the ground, broken, torn, faded by age and weather, tangled in knotted string. Still, I see beauty. Maybe only a piece of the prayer that once floated on the wind, a sliver. I stitch and tape and glue, and with caring smile, I fly with you. I don't normally often include other people in my poems, but my art does, so.
Okay.
I don't know if that makes any sense to you. We'll skip that one because it doesn't. I can see already.
You are listening to KVRF, Radio Free Palmer. We are a member-supported radio station, and we want to thank all of the members who make this station possible. Big Cabbage Radio, because of you.
About another prose poem. I like my prose poems.
Yeah.
Ready?
Yeah.
So this one's very, very old. It has to do with life as a very young man in the Lower East Side of New York City, college days, and the excitement of all that. It's called A Snow Night. The window is shiny and black, reflecting the apartment's interior in the heated discussion. Excited voices about Rousseau and Olmec Jaguars and other wonderful things bounce back like the lights. To see the winter storm, one pressed against the cold glass, but even that view was fogged by misted breath. The blurred scene was of a silent white city with streets mottled golden by shadows of snowflakes and amber streetlight. The only sound was unheard winds of little twisting devils. Though she was a daughter of warm sun and sea, she was not totally unfamiliar with snow. Snow properly belongs in the mountains to be viewed from afar, she would frequently tease, her cold forehead flattened by the glass shine moist and flush pink. Now well past midnight, bundle up, I said. We took to the streets, pushing little V-shaped wedges of shin-deep snow, mesmerized by the silence. Eyes shining from the mystery and the sharing, walking through the nearly empty village, neon from the cafes reflecting hell's red on the white. Though the ice-glazed windows, exuberant drunks and late-night poets could be seen in last call frenzy, To the train, I said, north to Wonderland. We climbed over the stone wall and through the brambles that would see fruit come spring. Under us, the strawberry fields, unmarked, but the trace of a brave squirrel's meanderings painted playful hunger. I sat on a bench under a park lamp, meaninglessly contemplating the forethought of the architecture that combined this wonder of nature and the worth of man. She just danced and danced, twirling and laughing and fleeing ghosts and batting them with their hands and digesting them on her tongue. Awakened, she stood shivering before me. Only her lace black boots remained to protect her, a crown of white fluff on her dark hair, shoulder and breast jeweled with small melted opals, and eyes with moonlight fire, a sculpture of truth. Warm me was all she gave me. There's one. That didn't go over so well.
That went over very well. I think just talking about it would ruin it.
Okay.
Yes.
We can do that. And I have one more, which is my, of that genre. I mean, I have hundreds of that genre, but one more that kind of fits with that. This one's called Renewed Dream. It's kind of my entry piece. I am blessed in the knowledge of how it is. Through the course of time, there are many paths that could have been traveled, and you hear, what if I had done such and such? Where would I be today? I am granted by dream continuing views of these other dimensions, the paths not taken. In one, I am a silly person high in the trenches near a clear mountain lake. Spring is in bloom, and the snow still lights on the peaks not far above me. Lavender little flowers highlight a meadow of grass just tall enough to shine silver in the warm breeze. The sky is that particular blue that only exists at tree line, and the clouds are pure. I get off my horse, a great Andalusian stallion with pink mane and tail and green eyes. He only responds to a sung Spanish, which, miraculously, I've learned. I bend over to cup some water from the brook that flows from the lake to the oceans I've never seen. I see my reflection, a gaunt old man who never grew the city paunch. My skin is leathery from the love of the weather, and an enormous crow's feet from worshipping the sun. My hair is white and rust, bleached from our star, tied with a leather thong with beads of amber. It's never been cut and hangs far below my butt. I also support a mustache of monstrous size, a braided Fu Manchu trimmed at my chest with tiny turquoises and porcupine quill. An eagle claw earring warns the spirits. I rest myself on a rounded gray boulder and straighten my right leg with my boot heel on another small piedra. Behind me is a chunk of Amez lava with mysterious petroglyphs. I can't decipher, but I know what they mean. My horse grazes calmly with reins down. The sun finds the remaining bright steel on my rusted spur and glints a giggle. My boot is wrapped in duct tape, holding hide and sole together. It is warm in the sun, and I take off my battered hat. I take out my tobacco and begin a roll of cigarette. Just as I am about to tongue the glue, a black mare with three white stockings and a star blaze runs out from the alpens. She stops and sees me. At a gentle trot, she comes towards me. She dismounts with the soft top. I look at her and her bare horse, except the braided rawhide bosal and its tender ropes. She looks at me and answers without words, "This mare won't take to the bit." I take her extended hand and rise, and we walk to the lake and bathe in the snowmelt water. Young trout shimmer in the lights, a surrealistic day of stars. We scrub each other with sand and gravel, then heat each other on the sun-warm grass perfumed by wild flowers. I laugh and she cries. It must sound like coyotes to the elk. She looks down, eyes alight in one tear track, a Mardi Gras marking on her soft cheek. I lay taking in the radiance. She turns away and dresses, faces the aspen. I want to see her face. She mounts the mare without turning and rides back into the forest. I dress and I resume my pose, taking up my cigarette and lighting it with the kitchen match. The sulfur smell is familiar and pleasant. I smile and think, what a wondrous gift, a broken heart.
Yes, wonderful. And so well put together. The feeling of myth, of a mythic character, and then the contact with this other beautiful mythic character. And that last line, that's the joy of a broken heart. It's just the what was it exactly? You know, the wondrous gift, a broken heart.
Well, it's kind of how I feel about it. Because if it doesn't get broken, you never had the other part of it.
Right. So, right.
Yeah. It, a lot of fun.
Very good.
I've got a couple of in-between stories, if you'd like. They're not poems, and they're not that kind of story.
Uh-huh.
These are, these all have won awards, believe it or not, at the press for their micro stories.
Yes. The Anchorage Press every year does a contest for micro stories.
Let's see if we can read them. One of them is very difficult because it's a lot of Eskimo words that I haven't used in 10 years, but we'll see. First one is about my dog, Lolly. I had an old Malamute, Kotzebue Malamute, small, big-footed, beautiful dog. I called her cheerleader dog because she was as pretty an animal as you could possibly imagine and as dumb as a box of rocks. That's probably not politically correct, but I said it anyways. So, my community of Fairview is the heart of my city. It's not a pretty sight, but the beating heart is beauty. Many who live here take on the ways of Alaska like the wolf, sheep, and caribou. Fur guy crawled from the burnt-out camper that he called home, dressed as always with animal skins adorning head to foot. Girlfriend and another fellow followed through the broken pane door of his blue tarp shelter on concrete blocks. "That your dog," he croaked, spying Lolly, the pampered Malamute, on his morning trip to the liquor store. Regulars some make it to work. Returning, Fur Guy and Entourage were well-greased with Alaskan spirits and needing release. "That kind of dog needs to run." We take her on several walks a day, and she has the entire backyard and garage, too. She's fine. "She needs to run free like a wolf." No, sadly, she'd get killed out here in the city. Besides, never, ever let a Malamute off her leash. It's the rule. I went indoors to avoid a physical altercation, to hear the dogyard gate metal bending in a chilling cry. "Free Lolly!" What a beautiful sight, a Malamute traveling across a snowscape city, free. But they like that one. Yeah.
Yeah. I can see why.
Yeah. That's, of course, a true story. The another... Here's my Eskimo one. Let's see how poorly we'll have to edit it.
That was a true story.
Lolly, yeah.
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 Okay.
These are all true stories. All one of these things happened. Okay. May have been a little younger, a little older, but I don't know how to make stuff up, so no one taught me that part. Aligatak was the loveliest in all the Arctic. Mother sent her on the blazing tundra to pick the last berries. Work went well and quickly in the autumn sun, heart occupied dreaming of Uyak and marriage. An ugly Arulatak, scarier than Tanik, appeared from nowhere. "Give yourself and bear my children. Never, I am Oyagux. Then you will be no one's." He used his mind powers to put her to sleep and threw her in a tundra pond. Snows came. The pond froze, encasing her in ice. Miserable Oyagux searched months for his love, for its tears. He knew he needed guidance. He gathered his friends. We're going to have a basket toss. "You will throw me so high that I can talk with the Inua where he flies and ask where he has taken her spirit." "I have not taken her. She is in prison. Wolf will be your tungch. Follow him and bring a stomach of seal oil." He followed Wolf, who could sense her spirit, finding her within the blue ice sleeping. He poured the oil on the ice. His fire freed and awakened her. The Imlilket was the finest ever. Aligatak and Ayak welcomed all. I can see that didn't make any sense to anyone either. all right. You know, I expect lots of rousing. Yeah.
Sometimes silence is a sign of appreciation.
Not on the radio.
On the radio. Okay. Well, I was not, that's right. I have a face for radio, but nothing else.
Let's see. I guess we have time for a couple others.
Yes.
This is the one I wrote for my wedding. Call it Proclamation. Two conversant friends travel the forest path, stumble and overturn a rock, laugh and join glee with this yellow-spotted salamander, such as we are. Two seekers climb the mountain, trust each other's firm grip of stone, and rely in the safety of each other. Share tea in the first light vision of morning, such as we are. Two great beasts take the yoke to lessen the burden, conquer more than as one, transcend a mystic dragons flying endlessly, side by side around the calliope carousel, such as we are. Two sit in contemplation on sea's shore, dance without fear and lengthening shadow. One sunset for both, one shared meal feeds two, such as we are. Two candle flames are joined, burn twice as bright, and mute the character of night, entwine two dreams to become one, such as we are. That is yesterday, that is today, that is tomorrow. To be as such are we.
Very good. Yes, and such as we are. Did that come first? Did you know when you were writing that poem that you were going to use the rhythm of referring to that very simple statement, such as we are?
Not when I started. I just wanted to write a poem about what my wedding meant.
Uh-huh.
And how things were between us. I think I caught it.
You did, yeah. That line that such as we are that just embraces everything. I thought it was very nice.
Well, thank you. This little piece is called Before. It's one of my tiny short stories. It's about the symbol Taiji Tu, often referred to as the yin yang symbol that is part of, especially part of Taoist religion. So here we go. Before. At the beginning of time, Wu Yin fluttered in the dream valley, the black void. She was like a beautiful dark hand of five fingers, and at the tips of her fingers, the eyes of the five elements glistened, and her palm was the red lotus blossom. For eons and eons, she moved gracefully, unbalanced and directionless on the river of time, until a petal of her blossom floated free. The petal transformed into her brother Wu Yang. He was bright and handsome, the opposite hand to herself, with five eyes of the elements as the tips of his fingers and the golden-eyed serpent in his palm. Together they viewed the empty void, his orange-scented light and her musky darkness. Then one day their fingers brushed and lightning filled the void. They had found passion and could not deny each other. They touched each other and the elements combined, fire and earth, metal and wood and water. The serpent pierced the lotus blossom and the lotus blossom consumed the serpent and they lay together, fingers on palm and palm on fingers, and two were one and two were two and became Taiji Tu. After time, the lotus seeds created from the love fell from the void and all things came to be formed by the union of the five elements and held in perfect fluid balance for all eternity.
Well, Gregory, these are amazing collection of stories and poems. One of the phrases that pops up about poems and literature is the poetry of place. And you're really a poet of places. Every poem sets us in a very specific place, but the place sort of evolves beyond itself. There's a mythic quality to the poems. The one about the Adelucin and the woman coming in on a on a horse, and the New York and Cambridge and Alaska, all these places are embraced here, and the life that you embrace in the poems is very clear. And coming back to what we were talking about in the very beginning about learning how to deal with mortality is a part of embracing the moment, embracing life, and I see you doing that throughout these works. So is there one more, or maybe two, that you would like to read?
Sure. And first, thank you very much. I've been a lot of places. I guess the best thing I can say is I've had a blessed life, and maybe that's what some people don't understand. I don't need to ask for more life because I've had such a wonderful life as it is. And I wouldn't deny it. Somebody wants to give me some more, I'll take it. But
it's not the
epitome. Look, there's the first poem in my collection. I'll read it. I wonder how bad it is. This was written out in the middle of the Mojave Desert by some railroad tracks going by, not too far from Kelso, if you know the area. And there was a chair, the white chair. In the desert with squinted eyes to see, find silently sitting the white wicker chair, aligned to the sea for each day's crash of the sun. Where is thee that left it here? In the great wheels of light, the universe turns. Orion guards the left and tumbles. The bear on the right hunts the blazing night. Sparks fly from the rim, star fall over the horizon. But no one sits in the white wicker chair. No commander bakes in the sun. No one hears the freezing desert song. Heedless, heedless, this vehicle goes on. Where is thee that left it here?
And the camera pans over to the white wicker chair, zooms in.
And there is a nice picture of it.
And the credits roll.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Is there more? You want to add? Is there another one?
I can always add more.
Okay, let's. Although that's such a great last image, but let's have one more.
Okay.
Let's have
a poem, a story,
another one, another two
of anything. Okay, I'll read The Rock, which is not quite as good a story as Renewed Dream, but it's still, I like it. It's been a long time. The Rock. The Rock was not an extraordinary rock. It was not too large or colorful, neither schisty nor sandy nor much lichen or moss. It was certainly large enough to stand on, even climb, if a couple ladder rungs makes an ascent. You could stumble into it, but not trip over it. One could sit on it, perhaps not fully in comfort, but in a half lotus, already suffering from contortions, it would do. Its roundness, though, was not suitable for laying upon. Should one want to gaze directly into the heavens or mull clouds? No, the universe was not attainable from this vantage. Maybe, like I said, the sport chooses the man, or in some such axiom, the rock chooses the passerby. Rocks in general are not transient like folks. When they do move, it's with great destructiveness, or so it would seem. It appears they only progress with external influence from forces beyond our ken. Sometimes, like keys or a wedding ring, they don't seem to be where we've left them. It makes one wonder if they might just not be animate, moving within dimensions of time we don't see. The lives of rocks and man interface in such strange ways. Many things about both can be said about the other. Hard as a rock, weathered and chiseled face of marble, or heart of stone. Indeed, there's much personality in rocks, and some in people. Though we rock the baby, we don't hit them with stones. It is said that David, of little stature, killed Goliath with the rock, and many dialed on the fields of Ilium from hurled stone because Achilles' heart had turned to stone. The Sanhedrin thought Stephen should be stoned and made sure of it. The rock foundation of our culture might best have been laid upon the philosopher's stone instead, so say many Kabbalists to this day. In the old ways of measurement, of one true measure of a man, it would be in stones, once a weighty matter. Curiously, we interpose rock and stone. This is probably not as it was meant to be, or probably not, in years forgotten, when we knew and spoke wisely of our nature with more fullness, how it was. A rock is made of stone, and a stone of rock, it's true, both, like ourselves, comprised of time and pressure. But rocks are not made of stones, nor stones of rocks. There's a uniqueness and singularity in their world as well. We would not belittle some rock looming on the horizon as a stone, though some magnificent stones, often set in preciousness, are definitely and derisively referred to as rocks. All rocks are rocks of the ages, that is their substance. And this rock, though unobtrusive as have may been, meets the eye, it could be the tip of a massive form buried from scrutiny. It could be like the Mormon rock precursored with Joshua trees, now petrified and turned to rock, or the red rock south of Denver, or maybe even like Uluru, the silent beating heart of Australia. Yes, this rock must be a great monolithic massif, and this barely noticeable protrusion must be the crest of some island mount, once ruler of some inland sea, some sands of time steadily bearing its omnipotence, leaving it loveless and impotent. Once surely its crest purely white and snow-capped was an inspiring beacon to creatures who may have perceived its monumental importance. It may have guided them to poetry in their lost language or aligned with some star or past day sunrise or azure sea below. It may have been the stuff of dreams. It may have been worshipped as some god. Maybe it should be worshipped still. Whether this is all that can be grasped or some unseen, some mysticism, some transcendent. After all, much less tangible gods are met with prostration and flagellation. God does not need to be noticeably big. We just need a big need to notice God. It is better that this rock is no longer distracted by turquoise skies and clouds of images. We can look down on this rock, head bowed. But of all things a rock can be, it's always a refuge. Better if a spring flows from some fissure in a tawny hide to a soft pool below, a refuge, an oasis, a coconut palm too. At times, though, as much comfort can be found in a well-worn pebble, worn by ancient glacier ice or greasy fingers matters not. Smooth and cool, timeless to the touch, seems to eradicate care and worry, comforting in times of trouble, not requiring understanding. One refuge is just being. Rocks seem good at that. A rock is firm, its strength is not ductile like steel. Rock loses it to the thinnest paper, but dulls the steel shears. Take some great granite wetted and glistened by a light mountain rain and beaten by a Christo-like artwork of flowing saffron fabric would be a more appropriate conquest to some, maybe bound in climber's nylon boot, cable to boot. The rock is subdued in either case. I've slipped, not a very firm understanding, and bloodied my knee and the coarse surface of this rock. The wound is just a scrape, and the pain will pass as a stain I've left to the winds and rains. From up here, the world seems small and curiously quiet. The city surrounding us, me and the rock, seems temporary and elusive. The rock and I, bound by my blood, seem to dizzily center the universe. It spins unknowingly around us. The speck of dust and the dust from which I came, with my chin on my knee, pass the time contently. That's enough.
Very good. Very good. That's a great conclusion. So, Gregory, thank you so much for the privilege of this hour with the conversation and poems and stories. It was a great pleasure and an honor to have you here and have this conversation.
Well, thank you, David. I hope you guys do more of this. Yeah, you need to encourage poetry, and you need to encourage poetry to be read, because it's different when it's read out loud than it's much different.
It's meant to be read out loud. Yeah.
Yeah.
Great. Thank you.